In 1886, Robert Louis Stevenson dreamed of Dr. Jekyll transforming into Mr. Hyde, a story that resonates universally because each of us harbors both a pleasant persona and a hidden nighttime self. This duality forms the core of Meeting the Shadow, Connie Zweig's groundbreaking exploration of our disowned selves. The book has become a cornerstone text in psychological circles, with figures from Carl Jung to Jordan Peterson citing its profound insights. Even celebrities like Russell Brand and Oprah Winfrey have referenced its teachings in discussions about personal growth and self-awareness. What makes this work so compelling is its universal application. Whether you're a spiritual seeker, psychology student, or someone simply trying to understand why you react so strongly to certain people, the shadow concept offers a powerful framework for self-discovery. As we navigate an increasingly polarized world where projection runs rampant, understanding our shadow has never been more culturally relevant or personally transformative. Beneath our conscious self-image lurks a counterpart Jung called the shadow. As light casts shade, our conscious self creates this darker twin. This relationship defines our humanity through imperfection. The shadow contains all we've disowned, aggression, shame, guilt, pain, yet paradoxically reveals our deepest humanity. Known by many names, the disowned self, the lower self, the dark twin, the double, repressed self, alter ego, or id, we use metaphorical language to describe encounters with this darker side, meeting demons, wrestling with devils, descending to the underworld, or experiencing the dark night of the soul. Jung posed a fascinating riddle. How do you find a lion that has swallowed you? Since the shadow is unconscious, we often don't know when we're under its sway. The shadow concept emerged from Freud and Jung's work, with Jung acknowledging Freud's analysis of the split between light and dark sides of the human psyche. Jung defined the shadow as the negative side of personality, those unpleasant qualities we hide, along with underdeveloped functions and contents of the personal unconscious. Unlike Freud, Jung saw the shadow not as totally immoral, but potentially containing values of high morality. Jung believed psychotherapy offers a ritual for bringing shadow awareness, reducing destructive potential, and releasing positive energy. His work provides explanations for personal antipathies and collective prejudices, addressing those seeking meaning beyond traditional faith and religion. As children, we begin with a 360-degree personality, energy radiating from all parts of our body and psyche. But parents disapprove of certain aspects, so we place these parts in an invisible bag to maintain their love. By school age, our bag grows as teachers contribute. Good children don't get angry over little things. By 12, we're known as nice boys or sweet girls, with bags already a mile long. High school peer pressure expands the bag further. By 20, we're left with just a thin slice of our original energy. When two such diminished people marry, even together, they don't make one whole person, creating honeymoon loneliness few admit to. Different cultures fill the bag with different contents. Christians often bag sexuality and spontaneity, while primitive cultures might bag individuality. We spend our first 20 years deciding what to put in the bag, then the rest trying to retrieve it. Each person inherits a psychological heritage transmitted through family dynamics. In this emotional center of gravity, ego development begins as children learn to repress what is wrong while identifying with what is reinforced as good to gain approval. This necessary process creates the shadow, a disowned self that becomes the mirror image of the ego. Though repressed, these qualities remain real, erupting unexpectedly under emotional stress. Parents shape their children's repression through direct commands, invalidation, and example. Children observe their parents' choices, pleasures, and rules, internalizing these as life models. The child first hides forbidden behaviors, then constructs an internal superego to police thoughts, ultimately repressing forbidden parts and creating a false self that both camouflages repression and protects from further injury. Whether becoming a tough guy, an attention seeker, or a hoarder, the child's adaptive strategy eventually becomes the source of further wounding when others criticize these traits. To maintain a positive self-image, the child denies these negative traits, creating a disowned self. Those parts of the false self too painful to acknowledge, yet constantly threatening to emerge. When a mother continues identifying with the archetypal all-protective role while harboring opposite feelings, the child experiences rejection and betrayal. Instead of transitioning from archetypal mother to human mother with nuanced emotions, the child finds himself caught between opposing archetypal forces. The positive mother who accepts unconditionally, and the negative mother who rejects his uniqueness and demands perfection. This wounds the child deeply, causing him to hide his individuality, which becomes incorporated into his shadow. Mothers often harbor unacknowledged envy toward their daughters' opportunities, the very opportunities they sacrificed to provide. Daughters sense this ambivalence and become trapped in a terrible inner division, trying to convince themselves their mothers were happy with their sacrifices while simultaneously denying any sacrifice occurred. This creates a complex knot binding the daughter's energies and ambitions. While everyone develops a shadow personality, parents must help children identify with proper psychological attributes without becoming overly identified with their shadow. Early bonding through love creates the foundation for moral life-relatedness to people and capacity for human feeling. Parents walk a narrow path. They must discourage destructive behavior while not cutting children off from their dark side entirely. Shadowboxing occurs in our most intimate relationships, where we encounter both our shadow and self. In siblings, we see mirror reflections that reveal profound identity and difference. Mythological pairs like Cain and Abel, or Jesus and Judas, demonstrate how the ego shadow dance can turn deadly. When one sees the other as enemy, both suffer. The key to healing these turbulent relationships is shadow work. Asking, what would my sibling do to access our undeveloped skills? In romantic relationships, we often fall for our opposites, attracted to qualities we lack. The shy woman with the outspoken man, the uncreative man with the artistic wife. If we don't develop it, we'll marry it. This marriage of opposites has cultural roots. The ego ideal of men, rational, dominant, represents the shadow of women's ideal, emotional, nurturing. Shadow work helps us face what Baldwin poetically expressed. One can only face in others what one can face in oneself. Yet not everything is projection. Some negative feelings toward genuine harm are valid. When couples struggle with opposing traits, they're often engaged in projective identification, a psychological mechanism where denied aspects of oneself are projected onto a partner. Consider Laura and Tom. Laura carried the intimacy needs for both, while Tom carried the autonomy needs. Rather than each person acknowledging both desires within themselves, they split the conflict down the middle. This arrangement allowed Laura to never own her need for personal space, while Tom never had to acknowledge his desire for emotional closeness. She pursued while he distanced, creating a dance where each depended on the other to express their disowned needs. When Tom needed closeness, he'd trigger Laura's pursuit. When Laura needed space, she relied on Tom's distancing. What should have been an internal conflict within each person became an interpersonal battle. Through projective identification, each partner encouraged the other to embody their disowned traits. Like the never-angry person who triggers rage in their spouse, then criticizes that very anger, couples often see in their partners what they cannot perceive in themselves and ceaselessly struggle to change it. For two millennia, the human body has lived in the shadow of Western culture. Its animal impulses, sexual passions, and decaying nature were banished to darkness by a priesthood valuing only spirit, mind, and rational thought. Science later confirmed the body as merely a chemical machine without soul. This created an entrenched mind-body split, with culture illuminating left-brain logic while shading right-brain intuition and carnal matter. This paradigm creates polarities everywhere: flesh, spirit, sinful, innocent, animal, godlike. We experience the consequences as guilt about bodily functions, lack of spontaneity, and chronic psychosomatic disease. The disowned body also manifests in epidemics of child abuse, sex addiction, and eating disorders. Religious traditions reinforce this split by proposing human evolution as transcending the body, while high-tech scientists suggest the body may become superfluous through electronic enhancements. Yet alternative paths exist. Somatic therapists view the body as a vehicle for transformation, a sacred temple for spiritual work. As John Conger states, "The body is our school, our lesson, our protagonist, our beloved enemy, the jumping-off place into higher realms. The shadow represents what we cannot acknowledge about ourselves, and our bodies often blatantly express what we consciously deny." As Jung noted in 1912, Christian emphasis on spirit inevitably leads to an unbearable depreciation of man's physical side. The body becomes shadow when it contains the tragic history of how spontaneous life energy is murdered until the body becomes a deadened object, with rationalized life promoted at the expense of natural vitality. To understand evil, we must approach it from its opposite, the good. In health, energy and consciousness are unified. A healthy person experiences a constant creative process, feelings of love and oneness with others, and positive direction in life. There is little sickness and no evil. In the diseased state, reality is distorted, the reality of the body, emotions, and the true nature of others. Evil is a distortion of naturally occurring facts. The sick person perceives troubles as coming from outside, abdicating personal responsibility. In psychosis, one sees the world as hostile. They are going to kill me, poison me. The personal downside of America's work ethic manifests in stress and burnout, while its collective shadow appears as ecological catastrophe. Workaholics sacrifice their lives for productivity, sometimes dreaming of security or contributing to greater welfare, sometimes simply unable to live any other way. Possessed by the demonic self rather than enchanted by creativity, they cannot release control. Workaholism is now recognized as an addiction, like gambling or overeating. Organizations often enable this shadow through unrealistic workloads, sales quotas, and drinking cultures that create severely imbalanced lifestyles. Everyone suffers. Families miss absent parents/spouses, workers experience physical and emotional deterioration, and corporations face high executive turnover. What prevents us from achieving our conscious goals? What sabotages our efforts and resists exposure to success? How do our workplaces undermine rather than support our goals? The workplace, though less recognized than family or school in shadow making, strongly influences how we adapt and succeed. We please bosses, colleagues, and customers by suppressing unacceptable parts, aggression, greed, competitiveness, outspoken opinions, into our private selves. Many find themselves having sold their soul to the company store through psychological compromise. Everyone is expected to seek success, but recently we've witnessed distortions in its definition, carrying shadow consequences. Success often arrives with built-in anxiety. Will it last? How can I get more? Do I deserve it? What if I lose it? Elation quickly transforms to worry, joy to chronic fatigue, depression, or existential crisis. During successful periods, we become inflated and suffer hubris, failing to confront our shadow. We stop self-observation beyond ego's frantic activity, fail at deep learning, and lose our true identities. People who function effectively in their work understand and integrate their limitations rather than fighting against them. These personal quirks and tendencies form the essence of one's expressive life. A restless executive who thinks best while walking the halls has earned acceptance through his superior thinking. A scientist who needs isolation in a company valuing an open-door policy stubbornly maintained her work style until others accepted it. One primary purpose of religion has always been to define the shadow, setting darkness against light and prescribing moral behavior accordingly. Every religion divides good from evil, with sharper divisions creating clearer ethics. In such black and white universes, right and wrong are distinct paths leading to heaven or hell. Some traditions recognize the relativity of dark and light. Maimonides noted that evils are evils only in relation to a certain thing. Jewish tradition acknowledges both wrathful and merciful aspects of God, while the Christian God, I am the light, is separated from the devil who contains only shadow. In Chinese Taoism, the yin-yang symbol shows opposites flowing into each other, with each pole containing the other. Mystical traditions suggest that shadow and evil have no objective reality, but are misplaced energies within us. As Joseph Campbell said, anyone unable to understand a god sees it as a devil. Mystical practices aim to harmonize malignant energies rather than fight external demons. Sufi poet Rumi points to this when saying, "If thou hast not seen the devil, look at thine own self." In Eastern traditions, shadow aspects are personified as gods or demons representing jealousy, envy, or greed, but viewed as parts of the meditator's mind. Occult traditions address the dark side with respect and caution, making the shadow a key figure with which to reckon. For many spiritual seekers, work with a mentor becomes shadow work, as the teacher exposes hidden aspects of the self. However, in the New Age movement, the shadow has often been ignored, with seekers believing they can transcend to higher awareness without confronting their vices. As Colorado journalist Mark Barash puts it, spirituality, as repackaged for the New Age, is a confection of love and light, purified of pilgrimage and penance, of defeat and descent. Recently, many gurus have fallen from pedestals revealing human foibles. Most brought unresolved personal issues, need for control, contempt for weakness, naive sexuality, hunger for money, that shaped their groups. Psychiatrist James Borden suggests a correlation between unexamined fears in spiritual leaders and traits enshrined as ideal in their groups. While the personal shadow is entirely subjective and can be engaged through moral effort, the collective shadow manifests as objective evil that rational approaches cannot touch, often leaving us feeling utterly powerless. Throughout history, evil has been understood through diverse cultural lenses. Aboriginal peoples associate it with literal darkness and malevolent spirits. Ancient Egyptians deified it as Set, the god of chaos and destruction. Persians conceptualized it through the eternal cosmic battle between Ahriman, darkness, and Ahura Mazda, light. Hindus view it as part of the karmic cycle of cause and effect, where negative actions create negative consequences across lifetimes. Collective evil manifests through mass phenomena where entire nations become possessed by archetypal forces, exemplified by Nazi persecution of Jews, McCarthy's anti-communist witch hunts, South African apartheid, and modern instances of ethnic cleansing. These movements are often personified in political leaders like Hitler, Stalin, or Pol Pot, who become vessels carrying collective projections of both power and darkness. While transformative movements led by figures like Gandhi, King, and Mandela have courageously confronted systemic evil, most individuals and societies continue to deny evil's dangerous presence in their midst. Sam Keen's analysis reveals how societies psychologically manufacture enemies before creating weapons to destroy them. He argues that humans are fundamentally homo hostilis, the enemy-making animal, who habitually project disowned aspects of themselves onto others. Through paranoid thinking, we split our idealized good self from our denied bad self, projecting the shadow onto designated enemies. This process involves dehumanization, stereotyping, and moral distancing that makes violence possible. The phenomenon of adversarial symbiosis emerges when nations or groups become locked in mutual projection, as seen in the Cold War between the US and USSR, where each superpower projected its own denied qualities onto the other. The paranoid mind, operating from deep insecurity, cannot accept equality or ambiguity. It must position itself as either superior or mortally threatened. This dualistic thinking creates moral paradoxes, where we are always innocent defenders while they are inherently guilty aggressors. Susan Griffin's feminist analysis explores how the chauvinist mind projects what it most fears in itself onto others, particularly women. She demonstrates how pornography's recurring imagery, women bound, silenced, beaten, symbolizes the chauvinist's profound fear of natural feeling, embodiment, and nature itself. The pornographer, like medieval church fathers, simultaneously rejects and desires knowledge of his own body and animalistic nature, projecting both this fear and forbidden desire onto women's bodies. This dynamic reveals how the collective shadow operates through gender relations, creating cycles of objectification and violence. The collective shadow thus operates through complex psychological and social mechanisms, projection, paranoia, dehumanization, that transform ordinary people into willing participants in systemic evil. Understanding these patterns is crucial for addressing collective violence and oppression at their psychological roots. Owning the shadow involves confronting and assimilating its contents into an enlarged self-concept. This healing encounter typically occurs in midlife, but can happen whenever life stagnates or loses meaning, when we feel the constriction of denial, doubt our values, or are overcome by powerful emotions. For most of us, shadow work is an eminently practical problem, requiring us to embrace what we've rejected and establish a new personal order that accounts for our destructive side. This process often demands relinquishing our illusions, which leads initially to despair, a kind of mourning period for our fantasies. Individuation aims at embracing both light and dark to create a constructive relationship between ego and self, often accelerated by a therapeutic witness. When we project negative qualities onto others, we equate negative with undesirable and thus fail to integrate these traits, seeing them in everyone but ourselves. Like Betty, who hates Jill for being a prude when none of their friends agree, we project our disowned traits onto others, transforming internal conflicts into external battles. Jung noted that accepting oneself is the essence of morality. It's easy to love the enemy outside, but what if we discover the enemy is within? Projection creates two problems. We believe we lack the projected quality, making it unavailable to us, and we see these qualities as terrifying external forces, essentially attacking ourselves with our own energy. The key difference between information and projection is emotional response. If someone merely informs us, we aren't projecting, but if they strongly affect us emotionally, we likely are. Undoing projection requires first taking responsibility for what we're doing to ourselves rather than blaming external forces, and second, reversing the projection's direction. For example, "the world rejects me" becomes "I reject the world." How do we practically retrieve projections and eat our shadow? Robert Bly suggests making our senses more acute, creating holes in our habits, visiting primitive tribes, playing music, creating frightening figures in clay, being alone, and regarding ourselves as genial criminals. Women might try being patriarchal at times, while men might try being witches, both playfully. When we identify who holds our projections, we can directly ask for them back. Through guided visualization and drawing, we can access parts of ourselves that have been closed to conscious awareness. These shadow images include imaginary characters, dream personalities, or people from daily life who symbolize uncomfortable or unattractive parts of ourselves, typically the opposite of our self-image. By making these images conscious through drawing, we can better visualize our disowned parts by seeing them first as objective images on paper. When we recognize these shadow qualities, we can incorporate hidden positive qualities like power, sexuality, assertiveness, or gentleness. The cure of the shadow is both a moral problem and a problem of love. Morally, we must recognize what we've repressed, how we deceive ourselves, and what we've hurt pursuing our goals. But equally important is how far our love extends to the broken, disgusting, and perverse parts of ourselves. If we approach ourselves merely to strengthen the ego, we miss the point. True healing requires loving all of oneself, including the shadow where one is inferior and socially unacceptable. This begins with simply carrying and caring for these rejected parts, not to make them comply with ego's goals, but with genuine acceptance. Eventually, a paradoxical breakthrough must occur, a laughing insight into one's own folly, a joyful acceptance of the inferior, while still maintaining moral recognition that these parts are burdensome and must change. One both tries hard and lets go, both judges harshly and joins gladly, combining Western moralism with Eastern abandon to hold the complete truth. The transition from the first to second half of life summons previously unconscious, neglected sides of the psyche. At midlife, the shadow emerges as a kind of number two personality when familiar patterns no longer work. Suddenly, you wake up one day and you are unexpectedly out of gas. This emergence creates a spiritual crisis where one must wrestle with whether the shadow is friend or foe. The integration process requires a sufficiently developed ego personality that can engage with the shadow without being consumed by it. This journey isn't undertaken lightly, involving the widening of consciousness by integrating what was formerly seen as evil. While the first half of life differentiates the shadow, the entire second half is dedicated to its greater integration. At midlife, a man must confront both destruction and creation as fundamental aspects of existence. His growing awareness of mortality intensifies his creative impulse while simultaneously heightening his recognition of destructive forces in nature, society, and himself. The developmental task involves acknowledging one's own destructiveness, both unintentional harm and deliberate hurtful actions, and taking responsibility for it. The central defect of evil, according to Scott Peck, is not the sin itself, but the refusal to acknowledge it. What we cannot face will catch us from behind. True strength comes from acknowledging our imperfect moral condition, freeing us from possession by demons. As long as we maintain that evil exists only externally, we remain on a course of destruction. When we acknowledge that the capacity for evil lives within us, we can make peace with our shadow. Though evil does exist externally and enemies do threaten us, any movement towards sanity can help create a more whole world order.